Heart. You gotta have heart. Miles and miles of heart.
What is heart? Heart is running through a return man when the game is on the line. Heart is giving everything you have in practice, day after day. Heart is finding the strength to run down the field one more time when you can barely breathe. The heart in me pumps Husker Red.
This is the Five Heart Podcast, and tonight I am in charge. John Johnston, the guy that runs Coronation, because Greg Mahochko and Haas could not, either one of them, be with us tonight because of family obligations or other things that happened. But I am joined by two beautiful women that write on my website, Beth Merrigan and Jill, the ranch babe. How are you both doing?
Great.
I'm okay. Volleyball's over, so I'm sad, but I'm good otherwise.
You have to say happy that Christmas is about here because I get to hang out with my oldest kid home from college. So that's always a good couple of weeks.
And I've got the little kids, so I've got the pure Christmas joy in my kids.
Okay, so Jill, you have the older kids. Beth, you have your kids are very young.
Yeah, my oldest is 7 and my youngest is 3, and 4 of them total.
Oh, so they still believe in Santa Claus.
Oh yeah, not even a whiff of anything else.
Oh my God. Was that a magical time in our lives, Jill?
Oh, absolutely. They're awesome at that age, except for the 3-year-olds. I could have locked my kids in a closet until they were 4, but I guess that probably shouldn't be published, should it?
Okay, well, I have to confess, and part of those – no, I'm not going to say that. I still want to believe in Santa Claus. I do, because there's a beauty about this time of the year. There's a beauty in the magic of the season, the Christmas, and the giving and the joy, and peace on earth and goodwill toward men, even though we don't, you know, necessarily practice that in our lives all the time. There's such a beauty in it. But Stanford crushed Wisconsin, Beth.
That was quite the intro to that. Yes, they did. That the last part I can say with all certainty that Stanford crushed Wisconsin, and the round before Stanford crushed Minnesota, and the round before Stanford crushed Penn State. I mean, the amount of Big Ten teams that Stanford crushed in this tournament is not a happy one for Big Ten fans in general, but yeah, in the most recent match, Stanford was just clearly better than Wisconsin in lots of facets of the game. And, you know, they beat them in their own game, essentially. Wisconsin is usually one of the best serving teams in the country, and they are. But Stanford was way better at serving, and Wisconsin probably had more reception errors, you know, than they've had all season, and that includes some of their early season losses. So it was an odd thing to see Wisconsin taken apart as they were by Stanford.
Do you think that's largely because they hadn't been there before? I mean, when you're going into, see, I'm the guy that I'm way more about the mental aspect of the game. And for people to listen to the podcast, they know that. Is it really hard? You coached. Is it really hard when you get to a level and you go, let's not freak out here, which really means let's freak out here?
Right. Yeah. Preparing for something that you've never experienced before, it's hard to recreate that in a practice setting or even in a game before the big game setting. So you've got to do some mental preparation, but even when you do that mental preparation, you don't truly know if the team is mentally prepared until they step out into the court and they pass the first ball. And but I don't know, you know, Wisconsin's played on big stages. They've gotten to semifinals. They've gotten to Elite Eights. They've got an Olympian on their team. So, you know, and the whole team didn't play badly. There's a couple players that did have bad games. But I don't think it was a stage that messed Wisconsin up on the whole. But yeah, for those couple of players, it might have been some stage fright, some, you know, lights turned on and the nerves tensed up. But in all, they didn't play a bad game. Stanford, of course, has played there before and showed no signs of jitters or nerves, no errors that I could say, oh yeah, she's a little too jazzed up for this game. She got too hyped and now she's hitting the ball out of bounds. But Wisconsin had a lot of errors. I could say, yeah, maybe 20% of Wisconsin errors happened off of, you know, nerves, too hyped, not played in this situation enough times. But I don't think, you know, their big stars, Sydney Hilly, their setter, Dana Retke, their big middle, I don't think they played at a level that would say, yeah, she's not been at here before. She's not playing well.
Catherine Plummer.
Oh my goodness. She is, she's like no player that I know how to compare her to. I listen, Karch Karai is one of the announcers and also the national team women's coach. And, I don't know who to compare her to. She dominates the game in such a way that I don't know what player before her or current is comparable. She's 6'6".
Ndamukong Suh.
that would be comparable, a LeBron James sort of thing. She's bigger, she's better, she's more calm about the game. She's got this zen quality to her on the court. She doesn't, you know, jump amazing, but she's 6'6", so she doesn't have to. She's really strong, and she's just fundamentally, she plays the game with so much knowledge and skill that it's hard to compare her to anybody inside the game of volleyball, including players on the national team.
Okay, Morgan.
She's going to have a long career in international volleyball.
I think so. I think she's going to – I'm curious to see how she translates. You know, she's a senior, so she's done in the college game. I'm curious to see how she translates internationally. If she is – on the Olympic team, you know, she didn't play this last summer. I don't know why, with the qualifying for the Olympics. And there were some college players that played with the national team. I'm curious to see how Catherine Plummer translates, because I think it'll be great, but I haven't seen it yet. And she's made no announcements so let's see how she does for Team USA now.
Okay. What about Morgan Hentz?
Morgan Hentz is amazing as well. The libero for Stanford does things in the defensive world that are hard to replicate. You know, she very flexible, very fast, great ability to read, to see what's about to happen in the play, and, you know, digs balls. The defender for Wisconsin is also excellent. Tiffany Clark, she's a senior as well. And when you were able to watch the two across the court from each other, Morgan Hentz was another step above Tiffany Clark. And Tiffany Clark has been amazing all year long for Wisconsin. So just another example of Stanford being visibly better than Wisconsin in this match, and out digging balls, out, you know, reading them, just not making errors. Stanford was largely error-free during this match and during the whole tournament. You know, one of their hitters came into this match and she had hit 70 odd balls throughout the tournament and made zero errors. That's unbelievable. She was hitting above 500 for the whole tournament. That's unbelievable.
Compare that okay. I'll say this for dumb males that are listening to this, compare that to like baseball.
Right. It's the closest thing in sports that a volleyball hitting percentage can be to a batting average. So really, yes, if a player was hitting 500 over a 70 at bat appearance, that would be comparable. And so you'd say, that's unbelievable. You can't believe that somebody could do that with such efficiency in volleyball.
And yet they did it. You know what they didn't do this year? They didn't run into their locker room and show a whiteboard with a gun.
I think they cleaned that up pretty good.
And then we didn't all have to freak out about how bad sportsmanship and just, oh, God, this is terrible and everything, whatever.
I'm glad that didn't happen this year. I am curious, with Nebraska having no seniors, what do you think the ceiling is for the Huskers next year? Nebraska has an exciting season in front of them. You've got all the players coming back, plus a couple of recruits coming in, and always hard to know how big a recruit is going to make an impact. I knew Maddie Kubik was good, but I had no idea how good and how well she'd perform in the college game. So, what we know is we've got all the players coming back, and so they've got a great look next season. The bad news, Wisconsin has a lot of their players coming back too. They really just lose three of the primary players that played this year. Madison Duello is the right side for Wisconsin. She'll graduate. Tiffany Clark, the libero I mentioned. And then one of their DSs, Emmy Dodge, will graduate. So all the major players for Wisconsin are coming back. Penn State returns a lot. Baylor returns. Yasiana Presley, that amazing outside, she comes back, and their setter, who was an All-American, she comes back. So I think Nebraska will be good, but we know
Minnesota loses a lot of seniors.
Yeah, they'll lose Hart, one of their outside hitters, who was great. She'll graduate. And then their transfer setter, Kylie Miller, she'll graduate. But they'll get everybody else. You know, Sambody will come back, right? She's a senior next year. I don't think so. No, I think she'll come back as well. Minnesota will be strong again.
The Big Ten is going to be tough as hell again.
Yeah, I think Purdue will be right in there as well. Purdue graduates one, but they'll have all their major players back. The big thing that if you don't graduate your setter, the one team we talked about that does graduate their setter is Minnesota. That's your quarterback. That's the person that's got to run the offense, understand the offense, have a rhythm with their hitters. And so none of those teams are graduating setters. Stanford graduated their setter and a lot of their players. Stanford was heavy seniors. But, Nebraska, along with a few other teams, has – a lot of brightness for their next year.
All right. So I'm trying to get this on. CC McGraw, my rotten son, has informed me as a good friend of his.
Ah.
And he attends the University of Minnesota. I don't know if that's true or not. I think he just says that so that he kind of goes, yeah, I know women. Or something. His girlfriend is in the band, in the marching band, and she does get to go to the Outback Bowl. But, okay, volleyball. The big news of volleyball was that John Cook lost a coach.
Yeah.
But he does about every year now, doesn't he?
He is.
Three of the last four. Years. So what do you – let's speculate. Let's have fun with this. Who's going to be the – John Cook, there's been speculation about his retirement. I think I just made that up because John Cook is a fine young man at the age of probably 50. He's younger than I am probably. He's certainly not as screwed up as I am. He's going to be around for a while, we hope. Could Danny Busboom Kelly be the next head coach in Nebraska?
I mean, Sure, she sure could. She's been at Louisville for 3 years, and we know Louisville had a great year this year. They beat Texas in the Elite Eight. Is that right? No, before that,
yes.
The Sweet 16. Louisville beat Texas in the Sweet 16. They did it with Lauren Stivrin, younger sister Amber Stivrins, and a couple other really great players. Yeah, she sure could. But I don't know what they're looking for in their next head coach, you know. And I agree with you. I don't think they're looking, right? John Cook.
Yeah, I don't think he's that close to retiring.
He seems like he's
older than you, John. I think he's early 60s, isn't he, Beth?
I do not keep track of coaches' ages. I do not know.
he seems younger than he is. I remember being surprised at how old he was.
63 years old. He was born on April 19th, 1956 in Chula Vista, California. On the other hand, Jill, nobody's older than me, really.
That's just according to Hoff.
So John Cook, 63 years old. I don't know. It's a reach, isn't it? God, I hope John.
I think what I'm also interested in, though, is who is going to be the next assistant. You know, Kayla Vanworth heading to Ole Miss. It'll be interesting to see what she does there. They're a 500 team, average season in the SEC. But who will become his next assistant, right? Because if we're watching these assistants go on to nice Division I programs and do nice things at them, then who's the next assistant? And
Justine Wong Arantes will come back this fast? Because I know he talked about her as an assistant, but he told her to go coach somewhere else before she came back to Nebraska. And I have no reason to suspect this, but that's one of the only names I know, so that's why I'm throwing it out.
Well, and she's still training with the national team. It's not that, you know, it's not always a full-time gig, but as they gear up for the Olympics, it becomes. So she's still competing to be that libero for the national team. He seems to like, Coach Cook likes to have former players, right? He doesn't just take the random volleyball person in the world, no matter how great they are. So I don't know. I don't know who's ready to cycle back through.
Terry Pettit had a book on volleyball, and then John Cook had a book on volleyball. Have you guys read those books?
I have read John Cook's, and I've listened to Terry Pettit's podcast, but I haven't read his book.
I read a ton of books. I do. I read books. But I think that when a football coach writes a book, 90% of the time it's a glory story. Okay? It's like a business book. It's like he's going, I'm going to retire from coaching and I want you to pay me $15,000 to do motivational speaking. When John Cook had his book done by Brandon Vogel, who I love Brandon, he's a friend of mine, but Terry Pettit wrote his book, neither one of those were really glory story books. They were more really about how do we do this and how do we compete? How do we get things done? And one of the things that struck me about John Cook's book was that he said a lot of volleyball coaches do not continue to coach like fundamentals during the season. In other words, they coach fundamentals during the off season, and then they during the season they stop. And he doesn't do that.
Yeah, he even talked about ramping up the fundamentals as they came deeper into the tournament or exited from the Big Ten season, and that the fundamentals were the things that he was going to emphasize as they came
and
into a more competitive.
And he calls the fundamentals training, right? Because he talks about a lot of coaches scrimmage, and he's like, no, we train. Am I right in interpreting that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I think, I think John Cook would say he's a teacher first, right? He's teaching the game. And I thought in his book, he was doing that, spreading knowledge and sharing that with as wide of an audience that wanted to have it. And this is how we do volleyball as a teacher of volleyball who has clearly been successful.
I don't know. I find it amazing that some of these guys, you know, when you're a coach, you're also a teacher. When you're a really good coach, and, you know, when we go through our lives, me and IT, you know, I run into a lot of guys that are like, they don't share their knowledge at all. They're like jealous of, you know, I'm this guy that maybe it's IT. I don't know. But that concept that some guy would write a book and share a bunch of knowledge is, I guess for a coach, you don't see that. I don't think a lot in college football coaches' books. Like I said, most of them are glory stories, but there you go.
Well, even if you look at Cook's approach to his assistants, he lets them do a lot of the coaching in games. You don't see him in the huddles as much as you do other head coaches. He's really teaching them and letting them teach the players, is my impression.
Yeah, I think he has the idea that he has these coaches there. He's obviously hired them, and they probably specialize in the certain areas, and so they are coaching them more. Like, we didn't see Kayla Banworth in the huddles as much because she was talking more one-on-one with setters and liberos, but we are going to see this next coach potentially specialize more in the setting and the defense again, whoever this next assistant coach is.
Okay, can I ask some stupid questions about volleyball, Beth?
Yes, let's talk stupid questions.
Let's say Michaela Ficke hits a kill, how fast is that ball going?
You know, somebody asked this on one of the game feeds, and I looked it up because I don't know the answer to that. And I looked at a couple of places, and I got to around 80 miles per hour. So I don't know that is the answer, but that's the research I did. What I do know is one of the techniques I've seen and we used when I coached was to use one of the, you know, police radar guns on serve. So we would tell our players, you know, we wanted the serve to be flat to the net, really close to the top of the net, below the height of the antenna, and we wanted it to be over 60 miles per hour. And so that makes sense to me then that when you're attacking the ball, you have more momentum, you can get more speed on it, would get up to 80 miles per hour.
So people can serve a ball at 60 miles an hour?
Yes.
That sounds
That's
terrible.
Remarkable, because I was watching my son try out some golf clubs, and I think the speed of the club as he was swinging on the machines they had was like in the 80s. And so for somebody to spike a ball with their arm versus, you know, a metal rod, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, someone's going to have to do this, to radar gun it. I'm sure coaches have done it, but this is what I've read. I think I'm quoting you good information.
Okay, so given that, when you have, like, again, let's say a Taylor Morgan from Minnesota or a Laura Stiverns, the new freshman we have, spiking a ball or hitting a ball, the reaction time of a libero to get that dig is what?
So that player, the defensive player, is watching the hitter, right? They're watching the ball, but they're mostly watching the hitter, the hand, and the shoulders of that hitter. So, I mean, it's half a second, a second. That's why sometimes it looks ridiculous that if the ball touches the block just a little bit and it moves the ball over just a touch that it looks ridiculous that she couldn't dig it, but she's watching the hand, she's watching the arm of the player. She thinks she sees the angle that she's hitting it at. You'll hear the announcers talk about, you know, the hitter dropping her thumb. That changes the angle the ball comes at. So, not much time at all. So if your hand is hitting the ball, you've got your hand flat, you're hitting the ball. If you drop your thumb down, like to the ground, it changes the whole angle that you're hitting the ball at and where the ball is going to be hit. So one shot that, you know, Michaela Fecky is going to hit is, you know, a thumb down shot, and she's going to turn her shoulders one direction and her hand the opposite direction, and that will fool the defensive players. Wrist away shot, you might hear somebody talk about. I know I might have to do videos this summer to explain what I'm talking about right now.
You know what? It might be interesting if you did that. I think it would be interesting. You know,
yeah,
because
I mean,
put it this way. I mean, people are okay. Not everybody. I'm not a great sports guy. I understand football, but I also understand somewhat of baseball, where you're throwing a knuckleball, a curve, a slider. It's the same thing, right?
Right. The pitcher's hand position, the rotation of the arm, the rotation of the wrist. Yeah, so you're comparing that to the hit I was just describing?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. So the hitter is, yes, playing the pitcher in this role. And turning the ball, you know, she's not going to necessarily put the spin on. That's not in a hit. That's not going to confuse the defense. But the way her hand and her wrist and her shoulders rotate is part of the shot that fools the defense. And so somebody like Michaela Fecky, somebody like Catherine Plummer has so many more shots than, you know, Maddie Kubik is really impressive, but she doesn't have the same number of shots, like the same number of pitches that a pitcher has. She's going to get more shots in this off season, right? That's the number one thing that somebody's going to work with her over the off season. But when you have 20 different shots you can hit, that's when you're beating the defense, because they adjust you, they go in your hole, and then you use your second shot and your third shot and your 20th shot.
What do you mean 20?
Not only the block. Yes, yes. So... okay, so the block is.
I mean, listen.
Away.
If you're going to be a college pitcher in baseball, and everybody knows, I think that if you're going to be a good college pitcher, you have to have 3 good pitches, not 20. And you're telling
right.
me that they can have 20 different shots in volleyball?
Well, yes, but the court is a lot bigger than the plate, right? So, if Catherine Plummer is going to hit the line, right, she's on the left-hand side of the court and she's going to hit the line, she can hit that a couple different ways. So there's 2 shots there that she has, right? And so I'm hitting the ball in the same spot, but in one shot, I face my shoulders totally towards the line and I just hit it down the line. In another shot, I turn my shoulders away from that line and then I hit it over my shoulder. So the volleyball court's bigger than the plate. Yes, an outside hitter can have 20 shots. She can roll the ball when it looks like she's going to hit the ball hard. I would even say you could have more than that if you think about hitting from the back row. You just made a whole different lineup of shots that are using the same fundamentals, the same basis of skills. But with repetition and practice and, you know, improved skill, you get a new shot.
Oh, my God. Jill?
I'm impressed. I love reading Beth's articles, and I'm loving hearing her describe it even more.
Terrifying.
You. Thank you for being part of Coronation Beth, by the way.
Well, it is. I tell my husband this is my guilty pleasure. You know, this is something I do solely for me, and the 4 kids can be screaming wherever. This is what I do for me, so I enjoy it. And you know, to have people listen to me talk about volleyball, what a dream!
20 shots. Okay, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I don't know what we're going to do, but we're going to come back.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. Not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
And we're back with the Five Heart Podcast with me as your host, John Johnston, and not those other two sons of bitches who just constantly drag me down all the time. But I'm joined by two beautiful women on our website. And by the way, if we, you know, I'm always game for more women writers. If there's more of you guys that want to come in and write about whatever you want to write about, just let me know. Jill, what are we going to talk about?
Oh, well, you know, we are ending a decade here. Do we want to look back a little bit? And I know that your memory is somewhat distorted, but, you know, some of us still can remember back to the early parts of this decade when things were a little brighter at times, for football anyway.
Beth?
Well, volleyball's had a great decade, so I'm fine talking about this decade. I haven't always been following Nebraska sports as closely. My husband and I just got married 10 years ago, so I only became a fan 10 years ago. So I guess I have this decade under my belt, but it took me a while to turn over to a Husker fan.
You're a native of this decade, yes.
So, okay.
Women's basketball 2010 was that undefeated team. You know, it started off pretty well.
So, Beth, for you got married, you're married 10 years now.
Yes.
Are you a fan of all the sports or just volleyball?
Well, I watched a lot of football with them. I don't know if I can say I'm a true fan because it's not, I mean, am I right? It's not been a great decade. I don't know. Could be making some
it's not been a
wrong
great
statements decade. Here. I don't know. But I have watched a lot of football with them. I can't say I've watched a lot of other sports for Nebraska, just mainly the volleyball.
Jill, would it be safe to say that it hasn't been a great decade for Nebraska football, except for the friends we made along the way?
Cherish those few memories where, you know, Kenny Bell throws a blindside block in the middle of Nebraska getting its butt kicked badly because that's all we got for this decade.
Oh, we joined the Big Ten. And it's been,
I think, a year from now. It's a decade. So we'll probably do some more decade stuff next year.
And our last year in the Big 12 was like they really wanted to give it to us.
Oh, yeah. I just finished I'm working on the ballots for the best and worst moments of Husker football for the decade. And I need to give credit where credit is due. Nate McHugh is the one who came up with this idea. It's just that he's in the middle of coaching basketball. So I'm the one who's pulling some of it together. But he did a lot of the initial legwork that it's going to look like I get credit for. But, yeah, I think the best moments ballot was published today, and I'm working on getting ready to publish the the worst ones tomorrow, and by the time you guys hear this, it may be closed already. But yeah, that 2010 game against Texas A&M, I started listing the reasons why that's on the worst moments of the decade, and there are so many. You start with, Taylor Martinez getting injured and getting yelled at by Bo Pelini on the sideline and, like, getting poked in the chest, and Sam Cotton getting, well, I don't know how to describe what Sam Cotton got in that pile, but he ended up with, what, 2 personal foul penalties and then a couple of what appear to be phantom penalties on Huskers. Courtney Osborne was it that had the roughing the passer, and Eric Martin had a penalty or something. That,
you know, I had relatives at that game. I had relatives. I had my brother was at that game, and then I had my other brother had a son at that game who was an Aggie, and they both came back after that game, and they said even the Aggie fans around them were like, "What is going on with this officiating? This is terrible." So even the A&M fans around them were like horrified at how bad the officiating was. You know, and it was pretty clear that. What's that?
And that game ended with a 9-6 score. It wasn't even it required a lot of work by the officials to do that kind of a score. That's a Big Ten score. Not a Big 12.
Right.
You know. And then that was the game where Carl Pelini got in trouble afterwards for breaking some photographer's camera, or trying to, I think. And it was just not a good situation all around. And it really, like you said, John, it looked like the Big 12 was telling Nebraska, yeah, you want to leave? Here's what you get.
It was a job.
We'll call it that. That's, yes. Yeah, it was not a game that anybody remembers fondly for any reason. So, spoiler alert, it appears on the worst moments of Husker football this decade ballot.
Does it? Well, that's
good. Okay. That and losing to Texas in the Redout Around the World game the same year.
Was that the one where Terrence Numb fumbled? No.
Oh gosh.
There's been a lot of bad times.
Yeah. No, I think that was just, yeah, that, I need to look that one up more now, because I don't remember the specifics of the game, just that we lost a game that was super hyped and Texas was bad and we were supposed to win. And that was one of Bo Pelini's best teams, and we lost at home.
Oh, God.
I know, depressing, right?
It is. It's been a hard decade for Nebraska football, but we're still here, I guess.
We made it. Yes. Hopefully there's brighter days ahead. You know, we're right now, we've got, what, 3 straight bowl-less seasons. Scott Frost era started off 0-6. More spoilers for ballot entries. We had a lot more entries for the worst moments than best for this decade.
You know what the best moment is? The best moment has to be the Northwestern Hail Mary. God, that's not even a – you know what? That was a nice win. And then there's Amir Abdullah over McNeese State, which is kind of like tragic because they're not that good a football team. And then
–
Yeah,
that one's on the best and worst ballot. The fact that he did it,
you know,
and the fact that we needed him to do it are both on the best and worst ballots. Jack Hoffman's touchdown run, I think, is currently leading on the good moments ballot.
Well, it should. I mean, that was a sweet. You know what happened after that? all of the other college football teams started copying that. And so what it did was it led to a lot more about what college football should actually be about, which is supporting people in their lives and oh God, I'm reaching. Yes, it is. It should be about, you know, the goodness of college football. Whatever. You know, out of that did become a really good thing. And I guess, you know, that's something to be proud of. It's just the on-the-field performance by Nebraska football is – my memory has been destroyed, but I do distinctly remember one moment in my life.
And that is?
Sorry. Give me a minute.
That's fine. Yeah, I mean, the reason most people are college football fans is because it is supposedly an amateur sport. You know, it's all about playing a game you love and trying to, you know, play it at a high level and being a part of something that's bigger than you. It's not about these recruiting stars. It's not about, you know, all this other, these trappings that have come to be because we love the game. You know, I've heard people talk about loving this game to death, and in some ways it's true. But, yeah, there's a reason that college football has a place in most of our hearts.
I remember standing at, you know, years ago when you were a student in Nebraska, you didn't have the shitty fucking horrible seats that they have now. Tom Osborne took those students and stuck them up in the corner of the stadium. And the reason why is because he's like, oh, we can sell better seats to everybody else. When I was there as a student, I had a seat at the 20-yard line that was up on the east side of the stadium, okay? It was a great student section. We were mostly, well, I didn't get horribly drunk for most of those games, but a lot of my friends got horribly drunk. But I do, the one moment I do remember that was very personal to me was, I could tell you stories about being in the student section, being, you know, and I've written about the 1982 Oklahoma game, which I went out and tore down the goalpost and almost died. But one moment that's very personal to me is standing there and watching all of this stuff go on and standing on a bleacher, you know, those wooden seats, and standing there and thinking, there will be a time which Nebraska is not this good anymore because all good things come to an end. And I thought to myself, what will we be then? Who will we be, Nebraska? Will we still, you know, the fight song says we'll stick together in all kinds of weather. But I thought, now we're going through 5-7 and 4-8, and I guess we're still sticking together. Maybe sometimes not because we don't know what else to do, but because we're hopeful. But I remember standing there and looking up the stadium and just standing there and letting all of that sink in, all of that just wonderful Nebraska football when we're kicking ass under Tom Osborne, and realizing we're not going to be here forever. We're not. And now we're where we are, and I hope people still love us, and I hope people still stick together like we're supposed to. When I write my articles, I say we a lot because I am a Nebraska alum, and to me, it's my fucking university. It is my state. It is my place. It is my, you know, there is no place like Nebraska.
Yeah, you're correct.
That's my rant for this podcast.
Well, you know, I think Beth and I both like can relate. We moved into the state, and you sort of are absorbed. Resistance is futile, right, Beth?
Yeah, I mean, it's everywhere. I mean, we have neighbors all around us in Scottsbluff that are true Nebraska fans, and we live a long ways from the University of Nebraska, but they love it. Like, we live there, and they drive there for games, and yes, they are just fans, pure and simple.
Well,
yeah, I mean, I'm not an alumni like you, John, but they gave me my first job out of college, you know, and now they're educating my oldest child. Yeah, how can you not be a Husker through and through, right?
So, Beth, what happened this week is, you know, I live in Minnesota. My rotten son goes to Minnesota. His girlfriend is in the Minnesota Marching Band. And yesterday, they're at my house, and my wife is explaining Nebraska to the girlfriend. Sorry. And she says, whenever you go into a store in Nebraska, literally 50% of the people or 75% of the people are wearing Nebraska. They're wearing red shirts. They're wearing Nebraska stuff. And that's how it is.
That's true. It's very true. I'm chuckling to myself because I'm picturing multiple situations where people are just wearing sweatshirts and garb in situations that it really shouldn't be happening. Weddings. I've seen people wear this stuff to weddings.
And it's okay because
it's the University
TV.
Of Nebraska. Yes.
It's
and
terrifying.
Weddings are gathered around a TV in the side room watching the game until they absolutely have to go do their obligation for the wedding. Yeah.
And
you walk into a store and there's speakers playing the game. And this is the part that I have a whole series of photos that I've never used on Coronation that I really need to start doing more with. But everywhere I go, people will have this little thing. Like, you just drive through any town, and there will be a large chunk of the houses that have some red in front of the house. It could be the stepping stones in the landscaping. It could be a little flag. It could be their mailbox painted with it. It could be something painted on the side of the garage. It could be, you know, some sign. It's not overwhelming, but it is, it's there. It's just the fabric of the state. And it is, it's interesting. I don't know how else to describe it. It's interesting in a good way.
Well, we have a whole off season to discover why that is. I personally think it's because Nebraska is such a damned hard place to live. You know what I mean? When we first started Nebraska, you know, Beth, you live in Scottsbluff. Imagine what it'll be like when in 1880, when those people were moving through and trying to settle that place. They had to give land away so that people could live there. Nebraska was a homestead state. The government said, if you can live on this land for 5 years, you can have it. That's how desperate they were to give Nebraska away to people who could have their own ownership of land. And I think that it establishes some kind of grit and toughness in a people, and it's been passed on for generations. And I don't know, part of our problem may be finding what that grit is. Maybe we're cursed.
Have to wander in the wilderness for a while every now and then. Yeah.
We have an entire off season to explore this. All right. Do we have anything else?
Have a very Merry Christmas.
Oh, we're supposed to end this with something.
I know what it is.
Okay, then you do it, Jill.
That said she knew what it was.
There's two parts to it, though, but I've learned this in my, this is my third podcast with everybody, so I'll do the first part. So I say, go Big Red.
Win the damn game.
Win the off season. There you go. It's the end of the Five Heart podcast hosted by your crappiest host ever, John Johnson. Woo!
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.